Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Girls Talk Crime. I'm Georgia. And of course, I'm joined by the Thunderjaw that is Amy.
Fuck you, hello.
And the Dribble Queen, Jenny.
Hi.
Well, me and Amy actually had an interesting few days because I went in to feed Georgia's cat a couple of times while she's on holiday, and me and Amy cleaned up Georgia's house and emptied her cupboards of out-of-date food, and we found food in there from 2016. You should be ashamed of yourself.
I just say I don't eat it, and I complain about not having food in the house, therefore it just goes to show I don't actually eat it. I just forget to clear it out. And also, I know you two had a fucking curry because there's poppadoms on the floor, so you didn't clean it that well.
It's fucking a lot cleaner than when we initially walked in.
Our followers or listeners are just going to think that I literally live in this like hoarding hellhole.
It literally is.
No, it's not. I would think we're gonna have to, one day we're going to have to take a picture of my living room so people know what I live like.
Yeah, but you'll tidy it up first.
Yeah, but just, yeah, if it was that bad, I wouldn't be able to tidy it.
I literally opened one of your drawers, I think it's like an example. You only open it and it's like, you have to like close it straight away. Do you know what I mean? Like music comes out of it or something.
Let me guess, that was the one in the living room.
Yeah. I'll try and find somewhere to put all her like shit letters, and then I open the drawer and I was like, shit letters from like 3 years ago.
I know, but I need to get a folder. I just keep meaning to organise it.
You don't need letters nowadays.
No, but like, they're, most of those are like bank statements and mortgage letters and stuff, which I need to keep.
For one, you shouldn't have bank statements delivered. You should have them online.
No, I still have them delivered.
Save the environment. You shouldn't. It's bad. Waste paper.
Gonna get hated on now.
I did enjoy the fact, though, Amy, every now and then she'd like find something or open something. She'd just go... she found a candle that you'd clearly fucked with and put a match in it, and she was like, why has she got this?
It's to work. I was trying to get, I knew the one you're on about, I was trying to hook the wick out with a match, and then I got pissed off and left.
It's gone now.
It's gone.
Oh, is it the pretty pot plant? It's the pretty
describe it and you can have it back. If you can remember what it was, you can have it back.
Well, I know, because it's already gone in the bin now.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, but
I bet you won't be able to. You can tell us what it was. Order.
It was in a white jar with like a white frosty pattern on it.
No, it wasn't.
What happened? No, it was.
Oh, see
there.
It was.
It'll be there for years. We have put decoys all around your house to see how much of a dirty tramp you are, to see how long it takes to find dirty things that we've hidden around your house.
Have you actually?
Tidy up.
I think Jenny's lying because Jenny does a little.
Human feces.
Jenny's a little smirky face. I think she's chatting shit.
If you are listening to this episode right now, can you just quickly go back and like, subscribe, follow?
And if you like the podcast, just share it with someone, because that's the best way for us to get out there. Their word of mouth, the old-fashioned way of communication.
Let's get back to it. So as it's now October and coming up to our favourite time of the year, we thought we'd discuss this horrific true crime tale that shocked a nation. So let's get started. Our story starts on January 7th, 1946, in Edgewater, Chicago, USA. 6-year-old Suzanne Degnan had presumably been sleeping on this cold winter's morning. However, this was not the case. Her parents had entered little Suzanne's room on the morning and found that little Suzanne had disappeared. Her father discovered a note on the floor of her bedroom.
Police were called, and from the note, it was apparent that this was a kidnapping. The kidnapper even made it obvious to police how he gained entry to the property by leaving his ladder propped up against Suzanne's bedroom window on the first floor. The ransom note read, pop in at any time, because the grammar on this note is really hard to read. Get 20,000 ready, spelt R-E-D-D-Y, and wait for word. Do not notify FBI or police. Bills in fives, tens. Burn this for her safety. Now, when you first read that note, I thought it may have been, you know, like the newspaper cuttings.
Yeah.
Kind of, you couldn't find letters, so you just put what you can together to, like, make a note.
It would explain the capitals and the little, and the lack of some E's and the spelling mistakes. It would make sense for it to be newspaper clippings.
Yeah, so we'll put a photo on our Insta page because you need to kind of look at it, kind of reading it out. Just sounds like a normal sentence, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all kind of lower caps, higher caps. There's like added letters that aren't supposed to be there, or it's not wrong. So it almost looks like kind of a child that doesn't quite know how to spell yet, or just maybe an adult that's just completely
uneducated.
Maybe, yeah.
A text message.
No, if you were Jenny, it would have a couple of numbers in it.
At the same time as the Degnan family had received their ransom note, the Chicago mayor, Edward Kelly, also received a note which said,
"This is to tell you how sorry I am not to get old Degnan instead of his girl. Roosevelt and the OPA made their own laws. Why shouldn't I and a lot more?"
That letter you just read there.
Yeah.
There's no spelling mistakes in that.
There is no spelling mistakes in that one.
And it's just like a normal letter. It's not been written in capitals and lower. Because it's almost like that's been written by a completely different person.
Yeah, right? An educated person, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's clearly maybe more of a local person because it's written in like more of a local tone.
Old instead of old.
Degnan, yeah. There was an ongoing nationwide meatpacker strike at the time of Suzanne's kidnapping. And the OPA, the Office of Price Administration, had been having talks of extending rationing to dairy products.
I don't even know what that means, really. Like, I've never been involved with a strike, so I don't really know what they do when it comes to striking. So obviously they're pissed off about meatpacking. I don't know.
Well, I don't think they're pissed off about meatpacking. They're probably pissed off about the pay or something like that. That's usually what a strike is about. It's to, right, well, you won't give us what we want, so none of us are going to go to work until you give us what we want.
I don't really know what that strike was about, but, you know.
But how does the rationing of dairy products
fall into meatpackers?
It's the wartime, isn't it?
Yes, so it could be something like that. So people are obviously pissed off.
Mm.
Anywho, James Degnan, Suzanne's father, was a senior OPA executive and had only recently transferred to Chicago. Another executive of the OPA had been assigned armed guards after receiving multiple threats against him and his children. Prior to Suzanne's kidnapping, a man involved in black market meat, whatever the hell that is, had been murdered by decapitation.
Ugh, I hope he wasn't the black market meat after that.
Went down to Tesco's.
No, they didn't, because there was a strike.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, we couldn't find anything on exact timescales. However, we are aware that the very same day that Suzanne was discovered missing, January 7th, an anonymous tip was put into the police to check the sewers. Now, this is where the crime almost gets too brutal to comprehend. In a sewer block, not far from the Degnan's residence, little Suzanne's head was found. That's right, you heard us correctly. Her head was found, which is just fucking horrific.
It is really brutal.
Do you ever just think, though, like, I think about the family and how awful that must be for them, but whoever had to find that, even if they were a professional, a member of the public, that would haunt you for the rest of your life.
It's gonna fuck you up. Yeah. No doubt. What's that word? Is it post-traumatic stress?
Yeah. Ugh.
Or in the war, I think they called it shell shock, didn't they?
Well, yeah, that's what they called it, yeah, and that's exactly what it is. It's post-traumatic disorder. I know when I was a child, I saw my next-door neighbour bury her hamster alive, and that still haunts me.
Are you sure that wasn't you?
Actually, no, it wasn't me. She literally put her in a sandpit and buried it alive. My mum never believed me.
And now she's a murderer.
Yeah.
In jail.
Shit. The police then found her right leg in the catch basin, her torso in another storm drain, and her left leg in a separate drain. Poor little Suzanne's arms weren't found until a month later, in another sewer. The delay in finding Suzanne's arms meant that she was actually buried without them. Oh, that's horrible.
I know. She's only six. This is clearly why it shocked a nation. It's, you know, terrible. And I can't even imagine being her parents. I know she had another sister. I think her name was Elizabeth. But obviously, just the age. It's brutal enough to happen to anyone. But for it to happen to a child is horrific. So, yeah,
and the fact that they've obviously had to piece it together and the family have had to make a decision where we've got enough of her to have a funeral and then bits of her all recovered afterwards. Yeah. It's so sad.
But it makes you think of that... obviously, it does make me think of the Ricky Gervais show and that point that Carl Pilkington makes about, you know, I don't want to donate my eyes because I don't want to go into the afterlife and not be able to see.
Yeah.
And it does make me think of that. Like, she's only 6 years old. You know, I'm sure she'd be whole if, like, she's a God believer. He would have brought her up to heaven whole. But it does make you think like that a little bit in a fucked up sort of way.
I didn't think of that. Donate your organs because people need them.
But not my eyes. I don't want to give my eyes.
Yeah, don't think in too much detail of that. Dan's mum had to get her, not her eyes replaced, but her, what do you call them?
Cornea. Bit,
is it cornea? Yeah, so that would have been from a dead person.
Yeah, you can get cornea replacement.
Yeah, and Dan said to her, oh, you won't see dead people. Like, but
there is a film about that, isn't there, though?
Yeah.
It's called...
The Eye?
The Eye, yeah, or The Eyes. And she does, doesn't she? She can see ghosts. Why are you laughing? Why are you fucking laughing?
She's like, what's it called? The Eye?
The Eye. Eye.
Coroner Brodie estimated that the time of death was between 12:30 and 1 a.m, which to us shows that there was never any hope of finding Suzanne alive. Coroner Brodie also said that the killer used a very sharp knife that had been expertly used to dismember the body. I know, it's horrible, isn't it? Just like, she's essentially a baby. Essentially.
But was the body dismembered to hide it? Is that what you, like, do you know what I mean? Or was it like a message?
You've got a point, I don't know.
Also, do we know at this point if there was any actual motivation to the killing? Breaking into a child's house, kidnapping them and dismembering them.
I've seen there's no real, what's the word? Not motivation or, can't remember the name.
Could they tell there's any assault?
No, as far as I'm aware, there's no sexual assault, and I'm pretty sure that the actual cause of death, or I am sure the cause of death was strangulation.
Mm.
So she died before she was dismembered. The coroner's expert, Dr. Kearns, stated that the killer was either a man who worked in a profession that required the study of anatomy, or one with a background in dissection. Not even the average doctor could be as skillful. It had to be a meat cutter. Brodie agreed and said it was a very clean job with no signs of hacking.
Police questioned hundreds of people and carried out over 170 polygraph examinations. Police had even claimed several times they had caught the killer. However, all were eventually released. Police had, however, discovered the crime scene, which was in the basement laundry room of 5901 Winthorpe Avenue, near the Degnan's home. It is believed that Susan was dismembered here. As this case was so massive, it stirred up lots of witnesses, and every lead had to be looked into. Multiple residents of the Degnan apartment said that the day before the murder, a woman was dressed in a man's coat and was chasing children, offering them candy. How fucking scary is that?
Was it the lady that you bumped into?
Oh, this fucking lady.
Probably was
her. But to be fair, I don't know what time of day this was. I'm assuming it would have been dark. Like, how could you see it was a woman in a man's coat?
This is the day before, so this is the day before the murder took place, so it was probably in the daytime, because quite a few residents had reported that one.
And what would kind of distinguish it as a man's coat? Or like a trench coat?
I imagine it'd be something like that, because back then I think women tended to wear more fitted, didn't they? Fitted coats, so it's probably on the looser side.
Ooh.
Of course. Quite.
Prim and proper.
Governor?
Now, I've just realised this isn't in England, so that kind of...
My friend Chris, shout out to Chris in America, she does the Chicago accent really fucking funny. She does so good.
We'll get a voice clip of Chris doing it then.
Yeah, we'll have to get a little audio clip. She'll love it. She loves doing accents. So anyway, Missy Crawford, who lived across the road, reported seeing a car containing a man and a woman repeatedly drive up and down the street at 2:30 a.m. And I think, most notably, Frieda Mayer, who lived above the laundry room, saw a man enter at 3:40 a.m., stay 10 to 15 minutes, then leave via the alley. He returned to the laundry room 15 minutes later. He stayed for several or so minutes before leaving and then returning one last time and only staying a very short period. So this, to me, is the most, in my opinion, that's a key witness. Like, she's just, I reckon, she has seen the disposal of Suzanne. And obviously they think time of death was between 12 and 1. So the time from 3:40, he could have been dismembering. And then from 3:40, he's then doing the disposal.
One of the police's first suspects, and one of their more notable, was Hector Verberg, a 65-year-old immigrant from Belgium. He was a janitor in the building where Susan lived. Police were so confident they had told the press, "This is our man." Even though there were discrepancies between Verberg and that of the one that was developed by the police as what skills the killer would have had. They had said that the ransom note was dirty, like a janitor's hands would be. A bit discriminating against janitors, isn't it?
No, they might be very, very clean, actually. They tend to wear gloves.
Police held Verberg for 40 hours of questioning and beatings, which was so severe he suffered a separated shoulder. That's how they did it back in those days, wasn't it? Just beat him, I guess.
Yeah, just bad cop,
I but, think. you just can't get accurate information from that. That's them trying to get someone to admit.
That is exactly what I think as well. They're like, right, we need to solve this case. Let's just beat the shit out. Beat it out of them.
Beat it out of them, and as soon as they confess, done.
And there how you go, case solved.
Take it off. He spent 10 days in the hospital after his beatings and interrogation. And he told press that if he had been subjected to any more torture, he would have confessed to anything. It also came about that he couldn't even write English. Not even well enough for the poor level of the English that was on the ransom note. He eventually successfully sued the police for $15,000. His wife also received $5,000 as police had tried to pressure her into implicating her husband for the crime.
It's fucked up. It's just lazy police work, in my opinion. Shoddy shit police work.
And he must have been so scared, especially if he didn't know very good English.
Yeah, and this is like the 40s as well. People didn't have the high level of education all the way through from, you know, 5 to 18 that we have now. Especially if he's come over to America from a different country, he's probably come over just to get some
work.
Like a well paid job, yeah. And, you know, education probably wasn't on the height of his list, so... I mean, that should have been something that they should have checked out straight away. Write something for us and then see how it compares to that ransom note.
But then I'm also thinking, is that like typical, oh, it can't be one of our own, it can't be an American, it must be a foreigner. You know, it could be something like that as well. Now, if you Google this case, you will see just how many people were treated as suspects. By April 1946, police had interviewed and cleared over 370 suspects. As is to be expected, the press then started to criticise the police's work and how well they were handling the case. I mean, I would probably be one of those, what the fuck are they doing there? I haven't caught a murderer yet, blah, blah, blah. I'd probably be thinking the same thing, to be fair. On June 26, 1946, William Herons, just 17 years old, was arrested on attempted burglary charges when he was seen breaking into an apartment. Police were called and Williams was trapped. Now, police accounts and Williams' accounts are different. You know, police say that he aimed the gun at them and it misfired, so he then charged at them. But then Williams says he turned and ran and the police charged him.
And apparently reports say a scuffle broke out and the police officer dropped 3 flower pots, one after another, onto Williams' head, rendering him unconscious. Much like that of Hector, the police became violent with their questioning. He was, according to Williams, interrogated for 6 consecutive days. But back in this time, was it not illegal to be violent when they...
They were allowed to, but obviously nowadays it's like people are confessing to things because they're so frightened.
There was no rule for it and there was no rule against it. Police could just do what they want. He was supposedly not allowed to eat or drink. He was not allowed to speak to his parents for 4 days and no lawyer for 6. 2 psychiatrists, Dr. Haynes and Roy Grinker, gave William sodium pentothal.
Pentathol,
without warrant and without his or his parents' consent. This drug is sometimes known as truth serum. Veritaserum for those Harry Potter fans. Hashtag. He was interviewed for 3 hours. Under the influence, he had spoken of an alternative personality called George, who had committed the crime or murders. But we will get to that later on. What he actually said is in dispute, as the original transcript has disappeared. How very suspicious.
So on the fifth day in questioning, William was given a lumbar puncture. The reason for this is slightly unclear. We're not entirely sure why he had it, but we do know that he was given it without anaesthesia. Procedure is taking fluid from the spine and the lower back through a hollow needle. And then he was driven to police headquarters for a polygraph test. However, he was in too much pain to do the test, so he had to reschedule. When he eventually did the test, the results were, drumroll please, inconclusive.
Waste of time.
Do you reckon they gave him this lumbar puncture because they'd like beat him up so severely and like some sort of like fluid retention?
It could be, yeah. So I think, yeah, lumbars are typically done to take, reduce fluid or for a diagnostic purpose, apparently. Okay. Not sure. Not a doctor. William was actually attributed as saying, while he was under the influence, that he met George, in quote marks, when he was 13 years old, and that it was George who sent him out prowling at night, and that he robbed for pleasure and killed like a cobra when cornered. George related his secrets to Williams. Williams allegedly claimed that he was always taking the rap for George, first for petty theft, then assault, and now murder. Psychologists explained at the time that in the same way children make up imaginary friends, William made up this personality to keep his antisocial feelings and actions separate from the person who could be the average son and student, date nice girls, and go to church. Yeah, that's what he's sort of claimed that he's got. He's got this, obviously, multiple personality.
Mm.
But then I also feel like he said that all under the influence, and he's just, I reckon, maybe like making stuff up. And I can't even begin to sort of wonder what it's about really in his head, why he said that.
He's really young as well, so don't they say that the effects of some more psychotic drugs have different effects on children like under the age of 21 because of how the brain is developed? So if they gave him that sort of drug, maybe it did just fuck him up a bit and he just started speaking absolute nonsense.
That completely
makes sense. When did you stop having an imaginary friend?
Never had one, but I wanted to have one, and I made one up, and she's called Sarah, and she lived in the corner of my toilet.
I never had one, but I wanted to have one, so I made one up. Yeah, Georgia, that's an imaginary friend. You had one.
No, but I couldn't, you know how people like kids are like convinced they can see them.
Well, I had imaginary friends.
I couldn't see it. I just pretended.
Did you?
Because I remember, now I'm going to find like a right psychopath here. I remember like I used to sit on the toilet and I'll talk to them, like have like full on conversations, and their names would keep changing because I'd like a name one time and then not like another time. But I remember getting to the point where I don't fucking want one of these friends anymore because it's weird. Like, I got to the point where I knew that I shouldn't have them anymore, and then
I never had that, but I was jealous because I think a couple of my friends at school were saying, oh, I've got an imaginary friend. I was like, oh, I fucking want one. So I just pretended I had one, and I didn't. I just made it up. But I remember my cousin, and this is my favourite, she came in a strop, and she's younger than me. She came in a strop, going, oh, I've got new friends. And then her mum went, well, why don't you go play with your imaginary friend? And my cousin goes, even he doesn't like me.
Oh.
She imagined her own friend didn't like her.
I had siblings, so there was no time for imaginary friends.
Only time for violence.
Only time for violence.
But like, I guess if you had like a mental illness, kind of, you would have probably those friends from a child, and then as you grow up, they would probably just stay with you. The only thing that slightly linked Williams to Suzanne's murder was the loops in the handwriting on the ransom note, which could provide a match to 65% of the population.
From what I've found, there can only be sort of a confirmed conviction if there's 12 points of reference or similarities. But within William Heron's case, there was only 9. So, again, it looks like they're just trying to tie up loose ends, doesn't it?
You know, and there could be more as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. This one is a bit of a headfuck case.
On the 5th of September 1946, William Herons was sentenced to 3 consecutive terms of life imprisonment for 3 murders and an additional 1 year to life for burglaries and assaults. The next day he arrived at Dateville Penitentiary in Joliet. Now, if I've said that completely wrong, I'm reading that as Joliet. There was no trial either before a judge or a jury. He had submitted a written confession that included not only the murder of Susan Degnan, but also the earlier and unsolved murders of Josephine Ross on the 3rd of June 1945 and Francis Brown on the 10th of December 1945. And he did this confession as a plea bargain. If I'm correct, do the murder, but if you do more than a murder, so you do multiple murders or like a burglary or whatever, that will instantly put you on to the death penalty. Because he did do a written confession for these crimes, that entered him into a plea bargain where he would just get life imprisonment and not the death sentence.
William Herons reluctantly agreed to the terms, but at a very public ceremony, cried when the state's attorney insisted upon the truth and answered many of the questions asked with, "I don't know." After this embarrassment, the state's attorney changed the terms of the plea bargain to 3 sentences to run consecutively. William Herons again reluctantly agreed to these terms. Now, I don't typically feel sorry for a convicted criminal, but this does remind me a lot of the Stephen Avery case and that of his nephew, Brendan Dassey. It feels like the police coerced this confession out of him.
He's not old enough to sort of kind of make these decisions to accept plea bargains. I hope hopefully he does have some sort of like lawyer or something involved.
Mm.
But you wouldn't know what was best for you at such a young age, really.
No, not at all. I mean, he is so young. I would be fucking sobbing the whole time if I didn't do it. And the vibe I get from this case is he didn't do it. Mm. This is what I think. But he was convicted to 3 consecutive life sentences. William actually died on March 5th, 2012, at the age of 83. He died in prison. He was the first person in Illinois to receive a college degree while an inmate in its prison system, and he was the longest serving inmate. Though he confessed to the 3 murders, he maintained that he did so only to avoid the electric chair, and very early on sought to have his sentence overturned. But that didn't happen. And, you know, he sought pardon and parole, but neither was granted, despite numerous attempts. I think there was 30. And by all accounts, he was a model prisoner. He created a number of innovative programs for fellow inmates. But sadly, he actually developed diabetes in his last years and was confined to a wheelchair. And he also suffered from dementia a couple of months prior to his death.
And in a way, so he's kind of saying he never did any of the murders.
When he got in prison, he was basically saying, "I didn't do it." From the second he got in there, it's by the sound of it, "I didn't do it." And I think there's interviews online with him, and there's definitely been books written about him stating his innocence.
So let's go back into the other 2 victims, Josephine Ross and Francis Brown. Josephine Ross was 43 years old when she was found dead by police in her apartment in Chicago on the 5th June 1945. She had been repeatedly stabbed. Her body was also found with a dress or skirt wrapped around her head. She had also been found to have been washed in her bathtub, and her wounds had been taped shut before she subsequently died. Around 3 months later, on the 10th of December 1945, Frances Brown, aged 32, was discovered with a bread knife lodged in her neck and a bullet wound to her head. Frances was also found in her apartment block in Chicago. She had been washed and she had been left draped over the bathtub. Her head was now wrapped in towels. Maybe a quick reach for something to stop the bleeding. That's what it sounds like to me. With Josephine, someone has grabbed her skirt to stop the bleeding. And also, why else would they tape up the wounds?
Yeah, I agree.
At the scene, police found a message written in lipstick on her living room wall. This read, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." This anonymous killer was branded the Lipstick Killer.
So this is actually what William Herons is actually known for. His name's now the Lipstick Killer, but he's not an educated... He's 17, for one. Mm. So to go from cleaning up and for these two murders, those two are quite similar, I think. So I think that was probably done by the same person. But then to go to a six-year-old and dismember her with surgical precision, it can't be him. He's 17.
It just doesn't add up.
So the murders of Josephine and Francis, it's like someone did it but then didn't want to do it, if that makes sense. Why are they almost trying to stop the bleeding? They're taping up cuts. They're covering her head to stop the bleeding. They're washing her to get their fingerprints off. Like, it's like a weird, or is it a weird fetish that they've got control or something? It's just...
Yeah.
But there's no dismemberment. There's no, you know, they're both kind of 43 and 32, whereas Suzanne was sick.
But then there's like also no attempt at hiding these bodies. They are just left in their apartments, whereas Suzanne was taken from hers, dismembered, and then like dumped in random different sewer locations. Personally, don't think William Herons is guilty of any of these murders. Yes, he's done a bit of petty theft and burglary. I don't think he's capable of killing someone. You know, even the notes say that he's a model inmate. By the sounds of it, he never got in any fights. And if you were that type of level of mental, you know, to do that to a child, you're most likely to be a little bit fucked up and sinister in prison as well, aren't you? Realistically.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we'll put the, on our Instagram, we'll put the note up from Suzanne's murder of the ransom, and we'll put the lipstick note up as well on the wall. Because although they kind of seem like they're done by someone that's not particularly well-educated, the kind of format is completely different. Like
they're
spelling,
so different.
They just seem quite different. They could be right.
But this is what he's been convicted for. So it's very, very, very much like making a serial killer. Or is that what it's called with the Stephen Avery?
Making a murderer.
That's it, my bad. Making a murderer. It's a lot like that, but obviously he never got granted release. Because, I mean, it could have very well, in turn, he could have been released and then started killing as a fuck you to the system. But, he never got the chance to, and, he died in prison.
Weird, though, isn't it? Because you think with all of the new advances in, you know, policing with DNA, they wouldn't have had any of that back then. But then I suppose they wouldn't have, because they didn't have anything, there would be no samples to go back and test.
I feel like it's a very corrupt police force. Like, we just need to get this under the wraps because we're getting shot at, you know, by the press saying we're this and that. But in my opinion, based on the original ransom note and the note that the mayor received and that guy who was also decapitated, the meatpacker, it does sound like an employee of the meatpacking industry out for revenge, because the dad was part of the OPA, which is to do with the thingy service, isn't he?
Regardless, kill the dad.
Yeah, but that's why it says in the note, doesn't it, that, well, I didn't mean, you know, I'm sorry, I had his little girl instead of him.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That does make sense.
But yeah, so to the listeners, do your own research on this if you find it interesting. I myself found it really, really interesting, really hard to research though, so sorry if we've got anything wrong. But this case is actually a bloody good read, and I would highly recommend it. It is very, very interesting.
It does sound like it's got a lot of different levels to it as well.
It does.
Like an onion.
Like an ogre.
So guys, we're now 1 week away. We're going to start doing our proper Halloween specials. So we've done some freaky cases this October, but the lead up to Halloween, so the week before, and on the week of Halloween, we're going to do some fucked up cases.
They're fucked.
They're fucked up.
If I can find them.
Yeah, we are still trudging through the internet. Give us a little bit of feedback, because we have had some ideas of maybe doing some stories that are internet stories, so things that don't have any truth behind them, more fiction stuff, if that's something you would like to hear. Or maybe we could do in our two-parters, one fiction and one true crime.
You know, what would you like? Give us some feedback. We would like to hear from you. These podcasts are not only for ourselves to have something to do of an evening, but they're also for you guys. So please do get in touch.
Hit us up. Let us know.
Press pause. Go on your social media. Go on to your podcast at whatever you're listening to this on and just follow us. It's 2 seconds.
Yeah. So that's obviously the likes of Instagram and Facebook at Girls Talk Crime. And obviously, like we always say, if you've got any recommendations or you want to say anything, just give us an email at girlstalkcrime@gmail.com. So join us next week.
Bye.